welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And let's get on into our editorial for today, our commentary. And today's commentary is written by Chad Hansen. Chad Hansen is the executive director of the John Muir Project and national director of the Sierra Club. He writes, "In 1989, my brother and I fulfilled a long-time dream of hiking the entire 2,700-mile length of the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada. When we reached the national forests of the Sierra Nevada, we began to see U.S. Forest Service signs posted on trees that read, 'Trail washed out, take detour.' We dutifully followed the hastily constructed detour trails, which often took us miles out of our way. One day, we came upon two men who were writing something on one of these signs. Seeing us approach, they hiked away quickly. They were on the, there on the detour sign was written, 'Clear cuts ahead, it's a scam.' Intrigued, we followed the regular trail. Soon the forest would give way to an enormous clear cut. The trail wasn't gone, but the forest was. Nothing but massive stumps were left. We caught up with the two men who turned out to be U.S. Forest Service employees. They told us they had been ordered by their bosses to put up the detour signs to conceal the agency's deforestation activities from hikers. From then on, we ignored the detour signs and continued to see the heart-wrenching devastation caused by logging on national forests. More than a decade later, after several years of hard work and citizen pressure, the Forest Service has finally produced its required long-term management plan for the entire Sierra Nevada range last January. The Sierra plan, while far from perfect, for once gives ecosystem recovery a higher priority than continued commercial logging. Responding to the public's increasing desire to see our national forest protected, the plan would reduce logging levels in the Sierra Nevada National Forest by more than half. The Sierra plan, however, could be eliminated before the new year by Mark Ray, the new Undersecretary of Agriculture who now oversees the National Forest System. The plan was upheld by Forest Service Chief Dale Bosworth in November, but Ray ordered a review on December 4th of last year of all documents upon which Bosworth based his decision. Ray's boss, Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman, wrote the timber industry's comments on the draft Sierra plan months before being named to her post. To avoid the appearance of impropriety, she left the decision on the Sierra plan to Ray. Ray, who was recently appointed by the Bush administration, was a timber industry lobbyist for nearly two decades. He was also responsible for writing the Salvage Logging Rider of 1995, which suspended federal environmental laws and allowed timber companies to clear-cut many thousands of acres of healthy, ancient forest under the guise of fire risk reduction. The fire issue is again being used by timber industry and the administration as a pretext to justify stalling the new Sierra plan. The federal government's own National Fire Plan, however, states that commercial logging should not be used for fire management because removal of large, mercantile trees from forests does not reduce fire risk and it may, in fact, increase such risk. The removal of mature trees through commercial thinning operations reduces forest canopy cover, degrading important wildlife habitat and creating hotter, drier conditions on the forest floor. Instead of timber sales, the National Fire Plan recommends the reduction of flammable undergrowth, shrubs, and saplings where unnatural accumulations have occurred. Timber companies, however, have no use for underbrush. They want to increase logging of economically valuable mature and old-growth trees on public lands. Ray is now poised to do their bidding, despite stacks of scientific studies concluding that such commercial logging causes severe fires. Like the old detour trick, the administration apparently hopes to misdirect the public one more time. So it's time to write and get in touch with your senator or congressperson and let them know that you support the Sierra Forest Plan and you want Mark Ray, the new Undersecretary of Agriculture, to sign it. This was written by Chad Hansen, the executive director of the John Muir Project and the national director of the Sierra Club. You can reach Chad at Chad Hansen, C-H-A-D-H-A-N-S-O-N, at Juno.com. And you can also view his webpage at www.johnmuirproject.org. That's www.johnmuirproject.org. Here's an independent study report. Not all wood is good. Industry SFI program falls far short of independent FSC certification program. The Meridian Institute has released a study of two major competing systems for certifying forest management, and they found they differ substantially in nearly all areas. The Institute is an independent Washington, D.C.-based think tank. The study compared the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, or SFI, of the American Forest and Paper Association, the wood products industry's principal trade association, with the Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC, the leading independent third-party forest certification system. And I want to add here that some have started to feel that the Forest Stewardship Council has started leaning toward the industry, but that's a different story. Going back to this one, the differences found by the study include SFI's failure to include many of the FSC's forest management and conservation standards and continued heavy influence over SFI by the American Fiber and Paper Association and the wood products industry, that's American Forest and Paper Association, excuse me. By contrast, the FSC is an independent nonprofit organization governed by a balanced membership of economic, environmental, and social interests. Green labeling can be very confusing, said Randy Spivak, director of American Lands. The Meridian study clearly shows the Forest Stewardship Council and the American Forest and Paper Association, SFI, are fundamentally different. The SFI fails to meet very basic criteria that consumers should expect from certified wood, such as protecting old growth, not harming endangered species, and minimizing the use of toxic chemicals. The FSC meets those criteria. I think consumers will want to know that, said Ms. Spivak. There's a reason why many environmental groups support the FSC but not SFI, said Bill Barclay of Greenpeace. SFI just represents the same old forestry industry. Virtually any timber company could meet SFI's weak standards. We commend Home Depot, Lowe's, and other major retailers for giving preference to Forest Stewardship Council certified products and promising to phase out other wood over time, said Carl Zakella, regional staff director for the Sierra Club. This study shows they made the right choice. The Meridian study notes that the American Forest and Paper Association's SFI often assumes that environmental and social concerns are addressed by existing laws. However, according to forest conservationists, most states' forestry rules fail to adequately protect imperiled species, old growth, water quality, and other values. Most states fail to require landowners to use sustainable logging levels. Many states in the Southeast and other regions lack forestry rules altogether. State and federal laws also do not ensure that workers are paid competitive wages or that companies reinvest in local communities. The Meridian study also notes that the American Forest and Paper Association's SFI lacks a consistent chain of custody system to ensure that labeled products actually come from certified forests. The system also has multiple logos. As a result, consumers will have a tough time knowing that what they're getting with SFI. The Forest Stewardship Council was created in the early 1900s by 1990s, excuse me, by environmental and social groups, foresters, and landowners to provide customers with a rigorous independent system for identifying products from ecologically, socially, and economically well-managed forests. While 8.3 million acres of industrial and non-industrial forests have been FSC certified in the U.S., many other companies do not yet meet the FSC standards. But that may change now that major retailers are beginning to express a preference for FSC-certified products. The American Forest and Paper Association responded by forming its own Sustainable Forestry Initiative, or SFI. SFI was designed to repair the industry's flagging public image and to begin moving companies toward sustainability. However, as noted by its critics, the SFI standards were designed to be easily met by most timber companies, including Pacific Lumber Maxam, Boise Cascade, Interfor of British Columbia, Sierra Pacific Industries, a major clear cutter in the Central Sierra of California, Plum Creek, a major timber liquidator in the Pacific Northwest, International Paper of the Southeast, and others that are logging old growth, harming endangered species and wetlands, converting more natural forests to impoverished plantations, and using excessive clear cuts and chemicals, and failing even to limit their timber harvest levels to timber growth levels. No major forest protection advocacy group supports the American Forest and Paper Association's SFI system. In contrast, the Forest Stewardship Council's membership includes a large number of forest protection advocacy groups as well as social interests. The Meridian study was sponsored jointly by Home Depot, the FSC, and the AF&PA-SFI. The study examined the two competing systems' documentation and official requirements, but also noted that comparisons of the systems' on-the-ground results still need to be conducted. If you're interested in looking at the Meridian study, it's available on the web at www.fscus.org and at www.merid.org. That's fscus.org and www.merid.org. There's a fact sheet on the Meridian study available at www.americanlands.org. That's www.americanlands.org, along with a critique of the SFI program and its standards. Let's go to some animal news here. Wondering why poisonous snake-eating snakes like king snakes are becoming rare? The king snake, so named because it eats poisonous snakes and is immune to their venom, is rapidly disappearing from Florida, according to a new research by a University of Florida scientist. Once common throughout the state, the king snake has vanished from many Florida counties, said Kenneth Christo, a University of Florida student who researched the snake's ecological status as part of his doctoral dissertation. Causes may include habitat loss, overzealous collection by reptile fans or dealers, and loss of genetic diversity, but scientists don't know the precise cause. They're not nearly as abundant as they used to be, and we don't know why, said F. Wayne King, a professor and herpetologist at University of Florida's Florida Museum of Natural History and chairman of Crisco's dissertation committee. Three king snake subspecies have traditionally occupied Florida. These are the Florida king snake, which dominates the Florida peninsula, the eastern king snake, which lives in the western panhandle, that's sort of strange, and a third as yet unnamed subspecies in the Apalachicola National Forest, identified by Christo as part of his research. Even within one subspecies, king snakes' appearances vary widely, but most king snakes have light-colored bands, blunted heads, and reach a maximum length of slightly over 6 feet. King snakes are unusual among snakes because their diet includes other snakes, including poisonous ones such as rattlesnakes, and they are immune to snake venom. King snakes are also relatively docile, a quality that makes them popular in the reptile trade and has contributed to their plight, Christo said. It's obvious that collecting has a real drastic effect on the population levels, especially in southern Miami-Dade County, he added. For his research, Christo called scientific literature, museum collections, and scientists' field notes for examples of king snake sightings or records in Florida dating back to 1858. The resulting geographic database suggests that while snakes once occupied at least 54 of Florida's 67 counties, their range has shrunk considerably in recent decades. Records indicate the existence of king snakes in only 23 counties between 1990 and 1999, despite an increase in the number of collectors and herpetologists in the field. Christo said the loss of the snake's favored habitat in woods near water bodies is one factor contributing to its decline. Much of the habitat that remains is disconnected, meaning the snakes can no longer share genes with neighboring populations. Another potential threat is the spread of non-native fire ants, which some scientists believe target king snake eggs and young. Still another danger is that as predators at the top of the food chain, king snakes may ingest damaging or deadly levels of heavy metals and pesticides, Christo added. There were at least four formerly large populations of king snakes statewide, including at Paynes Prairie and Aluche County. King said it was easy to find king snakes on the prairie in the 1950s and early 60s. Now they're gone, he said. They don't exist on the prairie as far as we know. Only one king snake population south of Lake Okeechobee in the sugarcane plantations remains healthy, Christo said. King snakes flourish in this area because the sugarcane fields and irrigation canals support large populations of snakes and other rodents, he said. Ironically, the planned Everglades restoration threatens this population because it will replace some sugarcane farms, he said. We've created this great habitat there for this species that has declined everywhere else. Christo and King said the study's findings indicate the king snake should be protected by the state of Florida. Florida currently has two snakes on its threatened list, the Atlantic salt marsh snake and the eastern indigo snake. And this story was written by Aaron Hoover of the Unisci Daily News. Moving to China, illegal bear bile farms have been uncovered. some of the black bears at the Dianchuan and Diani Bile factories in China's southwestern Yunnan province gnawed at their own paws to relieve the pain. Others in the cramped cages were not so lucky, having had their teeth and claws sawed off so that they could not hurt their minders. Cramped, ill, and in agony, hundreds, possibly more than 1,000 endangered black bears got good news when Chinese journalists uncovered two illegal bear bile factories where they were milked for their bile for use in Chinese medicine, state television reveals. Footage of one factory filmed by undercover reporters aired on China Central Television recently, showing the bears in small cages with surgically implanted tubes and valves for the collection of bile. This valve is just like a bicycle valve. There is a spring in it. If you pull the spring down, the bile dribbles out, and if you pull it up, it stops, an unidentified director of the factory said. The bear is used to it. Yet the footage showed bears yelping in pain as keepers extracted the bright green fluid, which has been harvested for thousands of years in Asia and is believed to be useful in treating fever, liver illnesses, and sore eyes. At the second factory, the bears have their teeth and claws removed, so they are not a threat to their handlers. All their teeth have been sawed off. The teeth are quite long before we sawed them off. We cut off their claws, so you can't see them now, an unidentified bear keeper at Diani factory said. Bear bile farms began in the 1980s in Asia after North Korea developed the method of bile tapping with catheters. China quickly adopted the practice, thinking it would reduce the number of bears killed in the wild for their bile. The industry in China mushroomed in the early 1990s when the number of captive bears hit 10,000 in 480 bear farms. It was also then that bear bile prices rocketed to 20,000 yuan, about $2,400 per kilogram. With the advent of synthetic bear bile and the greater awareness of the inhumane method of harvesting, the price has since plunged to about 2,000 yuan per kilogram, about $240. According to the same reports. However, the China Daily reported in August last year that one restaurant sold bear bile for 1,800 yuan per 100 milliliters. The paper said collecting bile from live bears had been banned by the Chinese government and black bears were protected by the Chinese Wildlife Protection Law. Today, Chinese medicine practitioners say there are herbs that serve the same purposes as bear bile, which is drawn from their gallbladders up to twice a day. The animal rights activists have been up in arms over the squalid and inhuman conditions in the illegal factories. The surgery on their bears, often without unsterilized equipment, often leads to chronic infections, some have said. The London-based World Society for the Protection of Animals said bears living in cramped cages or metal crates suffer from sores, bone deformities, bad food, poor hygiene, and poor veterinary care. The group launched a campaign last May protesting China's bid for the 2008 Olympics, saying its animal welfare record, particularly the prevalence of horrific bear bile farms, should disqualify the country. However, in July, China won the right to host the Games. And we thank Reuters News Service. Pygmy rabbit has gained protection under an emergency rule. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has granted immediate endangered species status to the Columbia Basin pygmy rabbit under the emergency rule provisions of the Endangered Species Act. This population of the pygmy rabbit, the smallest rabbit in North America, consists of fewer than 50 rabbits in Douglas County, Washington. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologists have determined that the Columbia Basin pygmy rabbit is threatened with extinction because of recent population declines, as well as ongoing disturbances to its sagebrush habitat, disease, predation, and loss of genetic diversity. An emergency listing provides immediate federal protection for 240 days, while the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service publishes a proposed rule under normal procedures to list the population as endangered. The public is invited to comment on the proposed rule and submit scientific information about the species status. The number of Columbia Basin pygmy rabbits in Washington has declined dramatically over the past decade, said Ann Badgley, director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Pacific Region. This distinct population of pygmy rabbits is extremely vulnerable to a variety of natural and human-caused threats, and the emergency rule provides immediate protection while we go through the normal process of proposing the population for listing. The Columbia Basin pygmy rabbit is a distinct population of native rabbit that once occupied Douglas, Grant, Lincoln, Adams, and Benton counties in central Washington. Pygmy rabbits occur in other areas of the West, but the Columbia Basin population is genetically unique, has been isolated from other populations for thousands of years, and occupies an unusual ecological setting. Although rabbits are often associated with a high reproductive capacity, scientists point out that such reproduction does not always translate into secure populations. Recent data indicate that pygmy rabbits may not have the same capacity for rapid reproduction as other species of hares and rabbits. In the spring of this year, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife began a captive breeding program for the Columbia Basin pygmy rabbit so that captive bred animals could be released into the wild to help recover the population. To date, 12 pygmy rabbits have been captured from the Columbia Basin population as an initial source for captive breeding efforts. The species now occurs only on state land, but efforts are underway to gain protected habitat for the pygmy rabbit on private agricultural land in Douglas County. And Alabama's vermilion darter has been called endangered. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has listed the vermilion darter, a bright, small, colored fish found only in Alabama, as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. The vermilion darter faces multiple threats, not the least of which is its genetic isolation and vulnerability to changes in water quality in the small streams in which it is found, said Southeast Regional Director Sam Hamilton. The service and its partners have already begun stream restoration efforts to benefit the darter, and with the added protection of the Endangered Species Act, we can begin the road to recovery. The vermilion darter is found only on 7.2 miles of Turkey Creek, a tributary of the Locust Fork of the Black Warrior River in Jefferson County, and the lowermost reaches of Dry Creek and Beaver Creek, where they intersect Turkey Creek. The vermilion darter is just under 3 inches in length, with a short head and a small, pronounced mouth. The darter faces many threats, including those posed by impoundments that have altered stream dynamics and reduced the species range, as well as excessive sedimentation and the presence of pollutants such as excess nutrients, pesticides, and other agricultural runoff that wash into Turkey Creek drainage. Other threats include reduced genetic diversity due to the darter's fragmented population, the potential for catastrophic events such as a chemical spill, could devastate its already low population. A local conservation group, the Society to Advance the Resources of Turkey Creek, or START, has worked through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Partners for Fish and Wildlife Program to minimize pollution within Turkey Creek. The Jefferson County Commission and START have also worked together to plan a nature preserve covering about 630 acres of the watershed. And we thank the Environment News Service. Well, that's all the time we have for news. To get news and announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email. Our email address is cruzeef@cruzeio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC and listen in. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so listen in anytime. You can always find Earth First Radio archived shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number for all.net, or at www.la.indymedia.org. That's www.la.indymedia.org. And search for Earth First Radio on either of those shows. This was show number 169. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. It's free. The show was produced by the Earth First Radio Collective in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off of the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to Daryl Cherney off his... Actually, it was originally a cassette. It's now on Uncle Dennis's Earth First CD number one. They sure don't make hippies like they used to off the CD of the same name.
Once there were some hippies living amongst the trees, picking flowers, smoking joints, hair down to their knees. Then one day they woke up to a nasty chainsaw's roar, and a logging crew was cutting down the public land next door. Now our hippies were not happy with Mother Nature going down, so they called their local congressmen and some bureaucrats in town. But our hippies' words weren't heeded, but they swore they would prevail. So they bought some Stanley hammers and some 60-penny nails. No, they sure don't make hippies like they used to. They used to live in peace, but now they're spiking trees. No, they sure don't make hippies like they used to. No, hippies don't take no shit anymore. When the loggers left that evening, the hippies snuck into the woods, and they figured that 500 spikes should fix that forest good. And they poured sand into the crankcase for to get a dozer sick. And they put nails down on the haul road to make their tires leak a bit. No, they sure don't make hippies like they used to. They once were stoned on grass, but now they're kicking ass. No, they sure don't make hippies like they used to. No, hippies don't take no shit anymore. The next day at the work site, the loggers had a big surprise. Their dozer engine seized up, and their tires dropped like flies. And before they could raise a chainsaw, they found this note and cursed, 'cause it read, no dice, these trees are spiked, sign love and peace, earth first. No, they sure don't make hippies like they used to. They used to speak of peace, but now they practice what they preach. No, they sure don't make hippies like they used to. No, hippies don't take no shit anymore. No, I'll tell you folks, hippies don't take no shit anymore.